Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry to interrupt your lunch. Can I have your attention, please? Welcome to the FCC. My name's Peter Hutchison. I'm a correspondent governor here. Before I introduce today's speaker, just a couple of housekeeping items. As usual, please make sure your mobile phones are off. If you need to take a call, please leave the room. I'd also like to mention a couple of upcoming talks that we've got. Got the president of the Associated Press coming up next week, and also the co-founder of Global Post. Today's speaker is Dan Washburn. He's written a fantastic book about golf in China. It's called The Forbidden Game, Golf and the Chinese Dream. He's going to talk about that book today, and then we'll take some questions. Please put your hands together and welcome Dan to the stage.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thanks, Peter. So I'll get right into it. And thank you to the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club for welcoming me here. This is very nice. I only have one thing to say about the photo that you're looking at now, and that's that the sky is not Photoshopped. I was very lucky to go to Beijing last year on the one blue sky day, perhaps of the entire fall. Hong Kong actually plays an important role in the fact that my book ever got published in the first place. I wrote this cover story for the Financial Times Weekend magazine, holed up in a hotel room at the Bishop Lay International House on Robinson Road. And that is the story that caught the eye of my publisher, One World Publications, in the UK. So I don't know if it wasn't for this story, I really don't know if the book would have seen the light of day. This story was about the very secretive and massive golf development that was planned in near Haikou on Hainan Island. It's now known as Mission Hills Haikou. Originally, in the early planning stages, it was supposed to be a 36-course complex that occupies a piece of land the size of Hong Kong Island, 1.5 times the size of Manhattan. And that's one of the reasons why, when I was down reporting on it, it had a code name, Project 791, it was called back then. It went from 36 courses planned to 22 when I was doing the reporting. It's 10 now, and I don't know if they're ever going to hit the magic number. So that's the story that perhaps is why I'm standing here right now. But I do have a confession to make. I'm actually not a golfer. This comes as a surprise to many. Golf seems to be a topic that people expect you to be a participant of the game to have an interest in writing it. I didn't grow up playing golf, and ironically, when I was living in China, I couldn't afford to play golf. It's very expensive, and I was just a freelance writer, and I could not afford the game. So I often get asked, well, how did you get involved in this topic? Well, that story actually begins in Hawaii. I was visiting my brother, who lives there, and I was seated around a dinner table, and there were some of my brother's in-laws and their friends. And another gentleman who was at the table was named Jason Sobel. And at that time, he was the golf editor for ESPN.com. Before I moved to China in 2002, I was a sports writer for a small newspaper in Northeast Georgia, near Atlanta. So we just started talking. ESPN was starting to look for more content about golf in China because more and more international tournaments were taking place there. I happen to be a sports writer based in China, so we thought, why not have me do some reporting on the topic? And back then, the assignments, my first assignments were pretty standard fare, covering these big international tournaments and trying to figure out why these big tournaments are going to a country where almost nobody plays the game. But it didn't take me long to realize that the story of golf in China is much bigger than just golf itself. So the elevator pitch for my book has always been a little difficult because, yes, it's easy to say it's a book about golf in China, but really I think it's a book about China that uses golf as an accessible window into larger issues in the country. So the reason why this photo is up on the screen, that's Tiger Woods playing in the HSBC Champions Tournament. That's the inaugural HSBC Champions Tournament in 2005 at Shanghai Shushan International Golf Club. That was Tiger's first official tournament appearance in mainland China. And that was one of the first events that I covered. But I wanted to do something a little bit different with my story from that event. So I got to the media center, and pretty soon after that, I left. I walked out of the clubhouse and then walked out of the gates of the club, knowing that I would eventually and probably quickly encounter a village or two. Most golf courses in mainland China are built in rural areas and usually right up against rural farms and villages. I just wanted to get a feel for what the local people thought of their neighbor, thought of the event that was going on, whether they've ever heard of golf or some guy named Tiger Woods. Very few of them had, understandably. So what I saw there, you had people living in shacks, literally in the shadow of multi-million dollar mansions. And I thought that was an image right there that kind of encapsulated, in a way, modern China. So I started to realize that, somewhat surprisingly, this sport that is enjoyed by statistically 0% of the Chinese population is actually a good way to explore and paint a portrait of modern China, and the China that I called home for 9 years. So you can say that the sport of golf and the emergence of golf and the rise of golf can be viewed as a barometer for the rising Chinese economy. And it's also a way, I saw that there was a way that I could also touch on a lot of key issues affecting modern China through the growth of the game there. I could talk about the gap between rich and poor, rural land rights disputes, environmental concerns, Wild West real estate development, and plenty and plenty of corruption. It was all involved in this one topic. And when we talk about corruption, new golf courses are in fact illegal in China. But no country in the world has built as many golf courses as China over the course of the past decade. Not even close. And I'll get to how that can be possible a little bit later. China has long had a complicated relationship with golf. Like many other things in the world, some claim that China actually invented golf. Peter, you're from Scotland, you may take issue with that claim. But there is no doubt that there was a small but thriving golf scene in certain parts of China, especially Shanghai, in the early 20th century. And it was enjoyed primarily by an elite and foreign class of people. There was a 1935 Fortune magazine story that documented the typical day in the life of a Shanghailander. And let me read you a passage. Some of it may sound familiar to some members at the FCC today. At noon, you make your way to a club for a leisurely lunch and two cocktails. You return to your office, but at 4:30, you knock off again for a game of golf at the Shanghai Golf Club or the Hangzhou Golf Club, both resembling the Westchester County variety, except for the attendants in white nightgowns. Scenes like that disappeared when Mao came to power in 1949. He banned the game of golf, calling it bourgeois. He denounced it as the sport for millionaires. A lot of the existing golf courses were dug up or repurposed. The Hongqiao Golf Club that was mentioned in the passage I just read is actually now home to the Shanghai Zoo. And the clubhouse still stands, and it's part of the administrative buildings for the Shanghai Zoo. Ironically now, we're three decades into golf's reemergence in modern China. Golf still today could be called the sport for millionaires. It is prohibitively expensive to play in China. It is definitely an elitist pursuit. The average Chinese person knows it as the rich man's game, if they've heard of golf at all. And that is one of the reasons why golf has remained a politically taboo topic, and it's tied to the corruption in the minds of many. No public official in China should be able to afford to play the game of golf on their salary. They shouldn't be able to afford greens fees. They shouldn't be able to afford memberships at the exclusive clubs. It also doesn't help that golf is a resource-dependent pursuit. In a nation with little arable land, 1.4 billion mouths to feed, and severe water shortages in certain parts of the country. So those are some of the reasons why it's been nearly three decades since we've seen a photo like this. This is Zhao Ziyang, the first and maybe the last Chinese leader to be open publicly about his golf habit. Now we know Zhao spent the last 15 years of his life under house arrest, chipping balls in his courtyard. Golf was not the primary reason for him being under house arrest. But given all of these complexities and the complicated world that golf exists in China, I felt that it would be a good backdrop for a book about the country. But how to tell that story. I didn't want it to be a dry work of nonfiction with one chapter about this topic, one chapter about another topic. I wanted it to feel alive, to read more like a novel than a piece of nonfiction. I want it to be character-driven and more show than tell, a ground-level view, not a 30,000-foot view. So I decided to tell the larger story through the very specific and personal stories of three men who are tied up in the golf scene in China in very different ways. They're relatable everyman, and I think they're imperfect, but hardworking and easy guys to root for. The gentleman on the screen right now, his story runs through the heart of the book. His name is Zhou Shunshu. He is a former peasant farmer turned security guard turned professional golfer. He grew up in a tiny dirt poor village on the top of a mountain in Guizhou province. And back then his only dream was to get out of the village. He eventually did in his early 20s. He went to Guangzhou, the boom town of the 90s. Looking for work, and he found work as a security guard at something called a golf course. That was the first time he'd ever heard the word golf in his life. And one of his jobs as a security guard was to follow the groups of golfers around the course and relay their whereabouts back to the clubhouse. And although the game with these men hitting this little white ball with a metal stick seemed very foreign to him, There was also something that seemed oddly familiar. It reminded him of his days back in the village as a young boy when they were out in the field grazing their cattle. The young boys would play games to pass the time. One of the games involved digging a hole in the ground, wadding up a ball of paper, and seeing who could hit it in the hole with their farming equipment or a stick of bamboo. They didn't call it golf, obviously, because nobody knew what golf was. But there was something about this game that Joe was watching that fascinated him, and he desperately wanted to give it a try. He was always an athletic guy and very competitive. But it was very frustrating for him because he was just a security guard and this was a private golf club. He was forbidden to play the game. He did not let that stop him, though. He devised ways that he could practice in secret. He took discarded clubs, he put them together. He would chip balls out in the back of the worker dormitory. He had an arrangement with the maintenance staff. If he broke any windows, he would be there to help them fix them. He would take a golf ball out in the middle of the night and would go into the green and would roll it on the grass under the moonlight just to see how the ball would move. So he really devised a way where he could train this game that he so desperately wanted to play. Years went by. He eventually was able to get on a course. And shortly after that, a couple years after that, he was teeing up on the fledgling China Tour as a professional golfer. So only in China, really, a story like that could happen. I really think that Joe, in many ways, embodies the Chinese dream, or at least a definition of the Chinese dream. You know, Xi Jinping, he may have his definition of the Chinese dream for the rejuvenation of the great Chinese nation. But if you talk to most everyday Chinese and ask them what their dreams are or how they would define the Chinese dream, you'll get very familiar responses. It'll sound very similar to the American dream, that if you work hard at something, you can create a better life for yourself and your family. And I think Joe and his inspiring underdog story is testament to that. The next of the three main characters in the book is a villager named Wang Libo. He lives in a tiny ancient village in Hainan province. He grew up in a house like the one that you're looking at, walls of uneven lava rock, dirt floor, tiled roofs. It's a very quaint village, even to this day. It's like stepping back in time. And his life was going along at a very leisurely pace, as things do in Hainan. Things were changing, but changing quite slowly. His family had a lychee farm. He also drove a three-wheeled truck back and forth to the Haikou wet market and would transport people as well. He spent some time working as a bricklayer, but life was just kind of plodding along at the typical island pace. That changed dramatically in 2007 when Wang and his fellow villagers found out that a new neighbor was moving in next door, a huge neighbor. And it was the development that I mentioned earlier, the Mission Hills Haikou, then known as Project 791. So Wang's story shows how a big development can create change in a place that has long been immune to change in many ways. And through his story, you see how adaptable people in many places in rural China need to be these days in the face of the breakneck development that's happening. And I think you also see some of the entrepreneurial spirit that I found in many places in rural China. Wang was one of the first villagers to agree to sell part of his land to the development. And when I say agree, I mean he was forced to sell his land, but he was one of the first to go ahead and do it. He knew the odds were stacked up against him. A villager going up against a local government and a powerful developer, he knew he didn't stand a chance. And so he wanted to get a move on and start trying to figure out how can he make this new neighbor work to his advantage, or at least try to create a better life for the next generation. So he called the government over, he sold his plots of land, and he started thinking of his next move. He knew he wasn't going to be able to be a lychee farmer anymore. That land was gone. But there was this plot of land that he was very lucky to hold on to. It was this triangular plot of land that he never did anything with before, but it happened to be right on the border of the Red Line. And the Red Line was the original boundary of the massive development. He didn't know what he was going to do with that at first, but he knew that that piece of land was going to be important. So he started building a wall. Normally, it's these big golf developments that build the walls to keep the riffraff out. But Wong, he wanted to make sure that the golf development did not encroach on his land. And I think what you see Wong do, I'm not going to give it away, but what Wong does with that land, he tries to make the best of a uncomfortable situation and try to secure a positive future for his children. And meanwhile, you see the village itself kind of get torn apart because there were definitely haves and have-nots. Not everybody was able to sell land to the developer. The final main character is an American named Martin Moore. Martin Moore, he builds golf courses. He's not a golf course architect. He's the guy that oversees the construction of the architect's drawings. And he ended up in China somewhat reluctantly in the early 1990s. He had already thought he had paid his dues in Asia, building courses in rural Thailand, and he thought he was headed to the Gold Coast in Australia and was dreaming about beaches, but someone in Kunming made him an offer he couldn't refuse. So he found himself going to Kunming, a place that he'd never heard of before, to build a golf course there. It's now known as Spring City Golf Course. It's consistently ranked as one of the top courses in China. Martin's story, when he went there in the 90s and when he stuck around in China after that first project, most people in his industry thought he was crazy. No one played golf in China. The industry was booming elsewhere in the world, especially in the United States. And so they kind of laughed at him. What are you doing in China? Those were the same people who, over the course of the last several years, were knocking on Martin's door with their resumes because China was the only place building golf courses for most of the last decade. So with Martin, you get a literal ground view of what it's like to do business in China, especially in a highly politicized industry and a very confusing and legally nebulous industry at that. So he doesn't work in an office, he's in the field, and I think he comes off as a very intelligent pragmatist. He saw something and stuck with it and learned that in China, most foreign companies know that they, when they're doing business in China, to some degree they have to play by China's rules. In the golf industry, no one really knows what the rules are. So you have to be patient. You have to be willing to change the way you operate. You can't expect to come in and change the way China operates. Martin understood that, and he saw a lot of people come and go who didn't have the patience, who didn't have the adaptability to exist in this Byzantine and highly politicized business landscape. And his story, obviously, is made all the more interesting because the legal gray area that golf course construction exists in China. So China officially, or most recently, banned the construction of new golf courses in 2004. That was not the first time that they banned the construction of golf courses. This story that you see on the screen is from 1993. There have been several different bans on golf course construction over the years. But 2004 was a little bit different in that golf was singled out by itself. The government cited the illegal seizure of farmland and an out-of-control real estate industry. All very valid concerns, but what they basically did was they banned it and then they turned their backs and let what they supposedly were trying to stop grow even more out of control and unregulated. In 2004, according to state media, there are around 176 courses in China, 11 of which were supposedly legal, meaning they had the word golf on their business license. Nowadays, no one really knows how many golf courses there are in China because it's grown so unregulated. Anywhere between 600 to 1,000 golf courses now, and you can imagine that the number of 11 legal courses is probably still the same. It got so out of control, in fact, that several years ago, the Chinese government was resorting to satellite photos. And they were trying to count the number of courses that they could count in the photographs to try to get a handle on the number. So, especially when I'm in the United States talking about the book, a lot of people just don't understand how can something be banned and booming in China? How can something be legal but also growing? Most of you in this room probably understand that a lot of things kind of play that role in China. Beijing can have a rule, but how it's interpreted or even ignored out in the provinces, you know, is up to the local officials' discretion. There's the saying, the mountain is high and the emperor is far away. And that really is an apt description here. The truth is, no golf course is getting built in China without government involvement. But all of that involvement is at the local level. Local governments actually often want this kind of development. They think that golf development will bring in a well-heeled clientele, will increase their tax base. But most importantly, they want these developments because the local governments are the ones who own the land. And they profit mightily from the land deals that result. And that comes back to Wang's story. The villagers are not dumb. They know that the developer is giving the local government a large sum of money, and the amount that trickles down to them is a tiny percentage. And they know that a lot of that money is going to line local officials' pockets. And that's where a lot of the tensions arise. I would say rule number one, when building a golf course in China, is don't call it a golf course. Throughout the planning stages, you never see the word golf in the planning documents. Maybe it's an eco space, or a green space, or a sports field. My personal favorite is the Yangshan District Land Consolidation and Ecological Restoration Project. That was the official name of the Mission Hills High Co. Development during its planning stages. I will, 2 minutes, so I will go faster. So I would say that over the course of the past decade, I want to get into a little bit, something that's changed very recently. The course of the past decade, the story was about the boom of golf in China, banned and booming. And you would hear quotes about this phenomenon. People would say, it's like the Oklahoma land run and the California gold rush combined. One professional said, I see no way in the world China's going to be able to put it to a halt. The amount of leads and new projects is just astronomical. And during the peak years, hundreds of courses were opening each year, and hundreds more entered into the planning stages. Many of those were like 10 course complexes. That became kind of the norm for a while. It was beyond anyone in the industry had seen before. another common quote, if you're not working in China, you probably aren't working at all. And that's because the number of golf courses in the United States was actually going down during this time. The only jobs were in China. Even with all the obstacles that existed in China in this industry, people were happy to have the jobs because they wouldn't be working otherwise. But things have changed a lot just in the past year. Now you see quotes like, big time golf development is absolutely over in China for the foreseeable future. Or all the lights are on and the cops are out at the curb. When I was in China last November, I encountered more pessimism and uncertainty than ever before. There were always crackdowns in the past, so there was always some level of uncertainty, but the only constant was that the number of golf courses in China was on the rise. Now it's pretty much come to a halt, and in fact there's rumors that China plans to close as many as 100 courses in the coming year. A lot of this has to do with the current business climate in China, and definitely has a lot to do with Xi Jinping's corruption crackdown as well. Because how are these illegal golf courses getting built other than with the help of corruption? So sometimes people ask me for predictions on what's next. One thing that I learned about predictions living in China is never to make them. So we'll just have to see what the future holds. So thank you.
Dan, thank you very much. I'd like to open the floor to some questions. Please wait for the microphone and identify yourself. Anyone? I'll kick off with a question then. China, as we know, is obsessed with gold medals at the Olympic Games. Golf is being reintroduced, I think, to the Games 2016 in Rio. Is that having an effect on the development of golf in China?
It's having an effect, but I don't think that it's having the effect that a lot of people anticipated when golf was named an Olympic sport several years ago. There were some wild predictions back then saying that now that golf's an Olympic sport, it's just going to open the floodgates and there's going to be a green light. There was a quote from Jack Nicklaus who said there were going to be 1,400 public golf courses in China. And just kind of a groundswell of golfers. Olympic golf has definitely changed the game in China. China is funneling an unprecedented amount of money into its national team program. And no other country is doing it to the extent that China is. So there's this elite group of golfers who are getting every aspect of their careers paid for, room and board, training, travel. And this is all in an effort to get more and more Chinese golfers competing on international professional golf events. Because with Olympic golf, you don't just create a team and head to Rio and say, oh, hey, here's the China Olympic golf team. You have to qualify based on world ranking points, and the only way you get those world ranking points is by competing on international professional tournaments. And there's been a dearth of Chinese golfers. It's not surprising. The first golf course didn't open until 1984. The term professional golfer didn't exist until 1994. Especially on the men's side, though, you haven't seen many Chinese names competing. It's happened a little faster on the women's side. But the way this development is happening is not a grassroots effort. It's not an effort to get as many Chinese playing the game as possible, and then the law of averages will say that you'll have a Chinese rise to the top. It's more of an inverted pyramid. If you get the attention of the national team, that means you've probably already been competing and performing well at the junior level, which means you probably came from a wealthy family who could afford to send you to tournaments and pay for a coach. So it's really pulling from the cream of the crop. But it did change what was happening before.
Thank you. I think Francis has a question.
Yeah, Francis Moriarty, freelance. You showed a picture of Zhao Ziyan. And I guess my question is two parts of one question. Is the game so associated with him at this point, and he is such a person who almost cannot be named in China, that anything associated with it is somehow anti-government or subversive in some way? And I relate that to those of us who covered the Sunnylands trip with Xi Jinping and Obama. We're wondering whether there would be any photograph of Xi Jinping with Obama on the golf course, and the answer is no. They went for walks, but and Obama played some golf with his aides, but Xi Jinping was not there. So I just wonder if that's an indicator of anathema, that golf is in China.
You know, there were rumors that Xi Jinping actually enjoyed the game when he was working in Fujian province. I've interviewed a couple people who have claimed to play with him. I don't know if they would come forward and say that now. That was before he rose to his current position. I do remember when I was covering the China tour, I encountered some folks that said if there was a photograph, and back then it was Hu Jintao, of Hu Jintao playing golf, you'd have a million new golfers the following day. I don't know if that's accurate, but a CGA official that I talked to then said that will never happen because of kind of the uproar that occurred related to Zhao Ziyang's public fascination with the game. I just think that right now the game of golf comes just saddled with so many issues that run counter to the stated goals of the government that they really need to keep it at arm's length. There are other ways that they embrace it, and that's, you know, with the Olympic program and also with hosting. They haven't stopped hosting these big international tournaments. But as far as some personal embrace of the game, I think that looks less likely now than it did just a couple of years ago.
Any questions from the floor at this stage? I've got another one then. China has a major winner in golf. It has the female player, Xiong Shangfeng. Do people in China, are they aware of who she is? Has her major victory had an impact at all?
Yeah, people you know, bring up, like, what will an Olympic champion mean to the game in China? Maybe thinking that maybe if someone won an Olympic medal, that would help the country embrace the game a little bit more. But I always do point out to them, well, you already have one of the top five female golfers in the world from China. She's won a major, which I would say in most parts of the world is more prestigious than an Olympic medal. But she, Feng Shanshan, will talk about going back to China and not getting recognized. She struggles to get domestic sponsors. I remember I called up her agency to find out if she did have any local sponsors, and the example they said was Buick. And they said that because it was the Chinese office of Buick that was sponsoring her. So I think that kind of shows the trepidation that some big companies have. Domestic companies have in embracing the game. It could be either because they see that the Chinese golf market is still very small, and the type of person that is a golf follower in China perhaps is more likely to gravitate towards the foreign luxury brands than a domestic brand. But it could also have something to do with the fact that it is still this kind of officially taboo topic, and nobody wants to be the first one to jump in.
Very interesting. I think we're approaching 2 o'clock. Oh, we have one question over here.
I played golf in Sanyar, which is the Mission Hills second complex with 10 golf courses. and the clubhouse is styled on Buckingham Palace and is about the same size, and I got lost in it. But it seemed to me that it's a very uneconomic basis for building a golf course. And if the corruption is going to be reduced, clearly a lot of corporate entertaining was done on the golf course. So do you envisage a decline in the playing of golf by businessmen who are the only guys who really can afford the huge fees?
I don't know if there'll be a decline in businessmen. There's definitely a decline in some of the lower level government officials who perhaps would have been joining the businessmen. But you talked about kind of the financial makeup of this development. You know, there are some cities in China that the golf courses are actually quite busy and it's hard to get a tee time. But a lot of the growth of courses did not come due to specifically a demand for more golf courses in China. The golf courses were a way to sell real estate, sell the luxury mansions that line the fairway, and that is the money-making angle. Most people I've talked to in the industry can't name a golf course in China that is making money from golf alone. So you'd have to think, once the houses are all bought up years from now, then what's the financial model then?
Florence, you have a question?
Yes, I was wondering if you could comment on the other sports in general, because golf may be an extreme, and I think we've seen that Xi Jinping is a fan of soccer and is trying to promote it. Do most sports in China have like credit, and some are good sports and some are bad sports? Or about tennis, which is also a little bit elite but yet democratic enough?
Tennis, if you look back a couple of decades, tennis was saddled with some of the same elitist reputation that golf had. The difference there is that a tennis court doesn't take that much land to build. You can build a tennis court in an urban area. Golf, as I said, is just so resource intensive that it's going to be a hot button issue, especially in a country like China. As for other sports, I'm not really an expert on other sports in China, but I know Olympic sports and team sports. Usually, I think, are thought of more favorably than some others. Golf is a unique beast in that it occupies a much more complicated landscape than anything else, except for maybe polo.
Yeah, that's right.
Final opportunity for one last question. No? Okay. Dan, you have copies of your book over there, which he can sign if anyone's interested in buying one. Thanks everyone for coming. Just one last round of applause for Dan.
Thank you very much.